Live, where we draw lessons of left organizers on electoral strategy. I'm Adam Gold, and I'm here with my co-host, Rishi Awatramani. Hey, Rish.
Hey, Adam. What's your post-election state of mind, bro?
I am tired, but I'm feeling grateful. I am feeling grateful. I was actually able to work on this election, you know, and I set out, you know, in my day job, we were really determined to defeat Trump. We were focusing on 7 states this year, and, you know, it looks like 6 of those went to Biden. And it's, you know, feels good to have participated, to contribute to that. But, you know, it was a crazy election. This was the biggest voter turnout ever in this country. And that feels significant. There was some really great voter defense work. I think a lot of people heard about voter guardians, vote defenders at the polls, hundreds of polls. And that just seems so important in this kind of current militarized situation that we were facing. Yeah, but at the same time, as much as I'm happy, I'm also worried. We'll get into that tonight, I'm sure. We face a big fight. And even you know, if the Democrats win in Georgia, then, you know, you still have almost a tie, and you have people like Joe Manchin in the Senate who are, you know, only marginally Democrats. So lots of work to be done.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that overview. I mean, I think for me, there's just a lot on my mind as we look ahead to what, you know, it's just going to be a really volatile period over the next few months. You know, there's a lot of sort of particulars to learn and particulars to discuss. But, you know, sort of obviously this persistent threat of Trump's attempt to justify invalidating the election results and to execute a coup of sorts is sort of top of my mind at this moment. I think it's pretty exceptional for the Republican caucus and the legislature to be sticking by a defeated incumbent president. You know, it suggests that either those legislators are invested in the strategy to invalidate and steal the election, or they anticipate that Trump's hold on party leadership is going to persist into the future. But, you know, however it goes down, there's a difficult question for us about what we can do to fracture or to split up the sort of Trumpian bloc. But from our side, from movement groups, I think, you know, there's going to be a really important set of questions to ask about how we consolidate our wins of this period, turning, you know, the electoral turnout gains of this moment into long-term organizing benefits. I think especially for sort of state and municipal groups that really, you know, focus a lot on turnout, you know, they're going to have to pivot into turning their attention to building long-term, durable majorities where they work. You know, that's going to require not only pivoting to organizing, but, you know, building the other sort of organizational muscles, other organizational infrastructure that we need, including things like political education that we, you know, sometimes ignore to our detriment, but, you know, also some of those sort of legislative functions that we need to drive progressive change. And, you know, you and I have been saying on this show that if we came into this post-election scenario, you know, in which Biden wins, but we don't have sort of a developed, you know, inside part of the inside-outside strategy, we're really not going to be in an advantageous position to prevent what we can call, you know, a reconsolidation around a pro-neoliberal pole in the party, the dominant pole in the party. And I think we see some of that unfolding. So the need for us to sort of have inside strategy soon is dire. And that all of that gets us to sort of the questions that we're going to focus on today, which is how we relate to this broad coalition that we brought in to defeat Trump, or that we were part of, you know, to defeat Trump. Was that just a tactical coalition that's now basically dead because of the electoral defeat of Trump? You know, can our forces be in some kind of aggressive struggle inside of that front in order to win progressive political change, you know, and not just progressive change, but also the sort of reforms required to change the electoral terrain in our favor? So all of those are, you know, some of the things we're going to try to dig into tonight, even as we sort of get into the concrete learnings. Let's get into it, Adam.
Great. So we do have an awesome panel. They are going to help us navigate through these questions. Today we have John Liss, the co-director of New Virginia Majority. Corby Shaw, Executive Director of Movement Law Lab. Brandon Snyder, Executive Director at Detroit Action. Welcome, Brandon. And we're waiting on Kendra Brooks, Philadelphia City Council member, who is wrapping up a meeting and then joining us. That is our crew. We do have a few seconds of housekeeping. We want to encourage everyone who's watching on Facebook and YouTube to throw your comments in the chat. There's often a lively discussion that happens there. And also, you know, this is an organizing upgrade project, so give that a like on Facebook. This is really one of the few places on the internet where left and racial justice organizers can seriously debate strategy. And one of the ways that we're able to sustain the work is through a bunch of volunteers that are on the, you know, team of organizing upgrade, and mostly donations. So any donations that you can give to organizing upgrade will really help keep shows like this, but also all the other material they produce online. Someone will post donation links in the chat. We want to say thank you to our partner on this show, Real News. They do all the production and make us look good as possible, and hold down all the tech and video production. We want to thank, for this episode, we also have Working Families Party, New Virginia Majority, Movement Law Lab, Detroit Action, who co-hosted and are helping to get this show out there. And all of you, big shout out to the viewers. We have a crew that's been really following the show and more each time. So thank you for joining us. Someone will be sharing the Twitter handles of our guests so you can also follow them. There are some great personalities both on the internet and in their organization. So please check them out. All right, Rishi, let's ask some questions.
Cool. John, starting with you. So, you know, for more than a decade now, you and your co-director Tram and the big team you have in Virginia these days have built one of the strongest state-based independent political organizations that, you know, it's really leveraged its longer history, longer than that decade of sort of grassroots organizing strength to defeat the right and win a progressive agenda. You know, in this election, we saw a whole bunch of these state-based groups, both new and old, bringing to bear similar tactics, similar strategies on this election. What's your evaluation of the impact of state-based strategies in this election, given how sort of prominent they were? What do you think the impact was, not just in terms of raw electoral turnout, but relative to, you know, the other left progressive groups that are kind of in the mix, and, you know, in relationship to the Democrats?
Yeah, no, thanks, Rishi. And thank you and Adam for having me on the show. I would start off by saying one caveat. I would say all of our whole sector, and I think everybody doing voter work, had some difficulty this year because of the pandemic. So there was limitations on how we could do the outreach, how we could do the consciousness raising, how we could do the organization building and moving of voters. So I would just put that as a backdrop. That said, behind every state where there was an exciting election and a transformation or flipping of potential or near flipping of power, or actually flipping of power and winning of an election, there's a powerful state-based independent political organization on the ground, whether it's Lucha in Arizona, TOP in Texas, New Georgia Project in Georgia, New Florida Majority, or New Virginia Majority. I mean, you can go through the list, but almost every place has a state-based power building organization that does outreach. I think one of the things we do is we try to have some level of political clarity and political alignment, but also scale. So too often, and I've been part of this movement for a long time, too often we focus on the couple blocks around our office and talk about moving, you know, in the tens, in the dozens, in the hundreds. And really, real politics needs to move in the tens of thousands and the hundreds of thousands if we're actually trying to struggle for state power. So I think that's the thing I would look at. And you can, even during a pandemic, you can talk about hundreds of thousands of contacts and attempts across, you know, state power organizations across this country. So I think that's really one of the undervalued and hidden secrets of a lot of what's been going on. I mean, from the Democratic Party point of view, they, I'm sure, view us as vended organizations, or not even, you know, sort of oblivious to us, even as we're moving voters and winning elections. And then from the folks to the left of us, you know, we're sort of, you know, in a weird way, also viewed as vended organizations out being sold to do this. I think what we're trying to do is hit that sweet spot where we're bringing together our sort of politics, sharp around race, sharp around class, sharp around gender, but also at a scale that matters.
Thanks. Well, you do somewhat similar work, Brandon. I don't know how that jives with you, and also kind of in particular, you know, a lot of folks watch the results coming in from Michigan last week, you know, and Wayne County results trickling in, pulling Michigan into the blue again this cycle. You're organizing in Black and Brown communities in Detroit. So yeah, how are you feeling about kind of the building, the role that John was describing, but also in particular to kind of your community and your work in Michigan? How is this different from 2016? What are you learning?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that jives with me, you know, pretty much right on the money, is that like what the work that we do at Detroit Action isn't about, you know, being a Democratic, you know, vended organization, or even being an entity that, you know, is solely designed to deliver a win for Biden or Terry Peters. It's about how do we build power for working class Detroiters. You know, our organization was built out of a homeless union and a SEIU Fight for Fair Economy campaign, you know, a sort of renter rally thing. And so for us, you know, our framework has shifted away from being this sort of turnout mechanism, but to be an independent political power machine. You know, like what I like to joke with our members and our staff is, you know, a union for the good. And for us, that means we defend our values, provide service, provide the political education and analysis. Also, at the end of the day, being able to provide people a home where they can see themselves and actually be able to see their values in the political process.
Yep. And did you find that, like, I mean, I think your organization was in a very different, I don't think you were there in 2016, like, at that position, right? But like, what role were you able to play in what, how do you feel like it went for Detroit and for Michigan 2020?
Yeah. So funny thing is, in 2016, I was actually on the here in Michigan.
You're on the campaign.
So a total different role than what we experience now. So so Detroit Action, I should take a step back in our origin story. So we relaunched last year. We were a homeless union and the SEIU are kind of two separate organizations. We had our marriage, but our SEIU Fighter campaign that we run, you know, was so quick. Get out the boat. You know, it didn't talk to people about the experiences that they wanted to have in Detroit. It talked to folks about, you know, what they saw, or even, you know, offer membership. It was about, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to turn out Black and Brown voters at any expense. And for us, you know, that's, you know, sort of paradoxical to the work that we want to do. You know, it's about turning folks out, but not just, you know, for the Democratic Party. It's about for power in and of ourselves, power to be able to make decisions, power to be able to have to win one of the housing issues that we care about, power that we want to be able to, that we want to be able to, you know, around COVID relief. And I think that, you know, the difference between that message, the message in 2016, and even the message that current Democrats give right now, is that it's really trying to attempt to inspire and engage folks to visualize more than just the current set of circumstances that our politics give us in this moment. You know, it's about, at the end of the day, you know, when we're talking to people, you know, who are at risk of losing their home, you know, at risk of being foreclosed on, it's about, like, what does it look like to have a COVID relief response? What does it look like to have you know, policy that actually cares about you and have elected officials that actually care about you or that respond to you. And I think that for our message and for what it looks like in Detroit, for Wayne County, when you talk about the work that we want to do or we did, you know, from 2016, there was about a 58% turnout in Wayne County. In 2020, you know, that number increased to 61%, which means that we added, you know, from our work, another 86,000 folks who resonate with the message of, you know, housing justice, you know, good jobs, good, you know, good schools, good neighborhoods, and, you know, around like how do we, you know, defund and refund for our neighborhoods. So, you know, I think that for our work, it's really about, you know, again, offering something different and really at the end of the day, being an independent political vessel that can, you know, offer a sort of counterbalance, you know, compared to the sort of neoliberal, you know, centrist, you know, BS that folks hear and get on their doors. That's that at the end of the day is, you know, mad transactional.
Yeah. That's helpful. Thanks, Dwayne. Yeah. I think we're hearing from a few viewers that we're having a little trouble with Brandon's audio. So we're going to work with him in between now and the next question. But in the meantime, you know, I do want to be able to ask Kendra about Philly. And while we're waiting for her to join us, Purvi, I want to come to you. We want to pivot a little bit and talk about, you know, the sort of persistent threat of Trump. So, you know, thanks to the efforts of a lot of folks, we went into Election Day almost overprepared for the potential violence and mayhem that we were expecting, most of which didn't actually materialize. And the Biden victory, you know, it provides relief to a lot of people. But in reality, Trump's antics and his refusal to concede, which in a lot of ways most everyone expected, you know, continue to pose a lot of danger of increasing violence as Trump rallies his troops against, you know, a transition of power, any meaningful transition of power. From a movement lawyer's perspective, how are you feeling about the recent developments? You know, what are the potential flashpoint moments we should be preparing for? What do you think grassroots groups and their lawyers can do to forestall Trump's chances, you know, with all of his legal maneuvers?
Yeah, I mean, again, thanks for having me. And I think that's a great question. I mean, I think one thing that's important to note about the actual election itself and our ability to stave off sort of intense voter suppression on that day is infrastructure that movements built, right? And I'm thinking about things like the election defenders, like the voter guardians. So I would just say, one, to give a shout out to movements that I think really did build infrastructure that allowed us to respond in real time with both sort of legal strategies, but more importantly, what I think has turned out to be really powerful organizing strategies to avoid confrontations at the polls and the kinds of incidents, whether it's police or vigilantes, that would disrupt people's ability to vote. So shout out to the election defenders for some brilliant work in doing sort of during the election. I think that, you know, let's talk about threats and ongoing threats. I mean, I think first, you know, Biden won, and it's clear Biden's won the vote, and there is, all sorts of people that are echoing that as something that we have clarity around. But I think at the same time, we're seeing a contestation playbook being put into motion by the opposing side. And so I want to talk about, like, there's been a flurry of activity even up and through today. And so just to list a few of the things. We've all heard about the lawsuits. There's been, I think, at this point, a dozen lawsuits that have been filed in a range of states, most of which have not really seemed very meritorious, but however, are moving forward. We've seen Republican Party leadership actually refusing to respect the outcome of the election. And we're seeing, you know, that's happening all throughout across the media. We've seen, you know, Secretary of State Pompeo saying that he believes there will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. You have in the Department of Justice, Attorney General Barr is loosening restrictions around when and how federal prosecutors could investigate election fraud, which is sort of unprecedented to allow the DOJ pre-state certification of election results. And that's leading to resignations in his department. In the Department of Defense, we're seeing the defense secretary fired and basically a bunch of people underneath, chief of staff and other undersecretaries are also resigning. And we see sort of attempts to thwart the administrative and bureaucratic process of a transition. So I say all this to say, right, like we can have a confidence in the results of the election, and it's pretty important to keep our finger on the pulse of these very quickly moving parts. And so I think what I'd like to say about the legal piece of this is, you know, I think that what has given people a lot of comfort is a belief that the lawsuits are meritless, or that there's no sort of, currently there's not a sort of path forward in which the Supreme Court would be the arbiter of this election. But I think what people are perhaps might be a useful insight is that I don't think these lawsuits are about the law. I think they are a narrative and a comm strategy to build a groundswell of opinion in particularly Trump's base that the outcome of the election was not valid. And we're seeing that mobilization sort of activating, right? We have the Million MAGA rally, which is supposed to be happening. We're seeing all sorts of other ways where this base of people are believing
that he believes there will
that the election results were not fair. So I would say, like, you know, I think at the heart of this is what is I think the movement has to think about, and this is not sort of in the purview of a movement lawyer, but I think this idea of this is a credible threat, and then if it is a comms and mobilization strategy, then how do we think about our response in terms of communications and mobilization? And there's more to say about that, but I'm hoping that's the discussion we can get further into.
Yeah, we will definitely come back to that. Thank you, Parveen. I want to welcome Councilwoman Kendra Brooks for jumping on this call. You may have missed part of that answer, but, you know, Councilwoman, you know, you are in Philadelphia, another kind of heart of where this election went down, where people were defending the polls, where people were turning out voters. Now you see what's unfolding as Purvi described. You know, what is your sense of kind of what comes next? Have we won and now we let the kind of mechanisms of power unfold? Do we need to be in the streets? What is your sense of kind of what's next for Philadelphia and for the country, given where we stand in the middle of this, interim period?
Yeah. So I feel that from the beginning that this victory, like getting the Biden Harris ticket elected, was like the first step. Like, it really wasn't about that. It was mainly about mobilizing folks to get involved in the process. And regardless of what this administration does, the victory is making sure that people are prepared and mobilized and educated for whatever's next. I know here in Philadelphia, we spend a lot of time doing voter mobilization, you know, about issues and getting people excited about the issues that are most important to them as a reason to vote. And the tactics of our current administration are not new. This is the things that, you know, he has been doing since he's been there. I think the realization is that here in Philadelphia, we're prepared to take it to the streets. Like, his folks, his crew came into Philadelphia and thought they were going to do intimidation of the folks at the voter count center, and Philadelphia showed up. We were there, we were present. And that is what our plan is, to continue to mobilize, continue to take to the streets, because we realize, regardless of who's in the office, we have to continue to stay vigilant. Part of the problem is that, you know, we have become complacent and just allowing things to happen to us. And I think the message right now is that we have to be a part of the process and involved every step of the way. So, you know, I'm seeing it as a way to continually to engage folks, because we're used to having an election and it's it, right? Whoever won walks out graciously. We knew that wasn't going to happen with our current administration. And I think that's even more why we have to continue to take to the streets and continue to educate and mobilize the folks who won the election. You know, our Black voters here in Philadelphia, in Detroit, in Georgia, like, this is what it's about. We can't back down. And this is kind of a testament of what we can never do again. You know, we have been encouraged to go to the polls and vote before in the past, but we haven't been motivated to be a part of the change process. And I think that's something that we saw in 2016. And then even now in 2020, regardless of who's in the White House, we can't sit back and just allow things to happen. We always have to be vigilant and prepared to take it to the streets.
Gotcha. Thanks, Councilwoman. Really appreciate that. I want to stay on this theme actually for a minute and bring John in. I'm not sure if our production team can pull up this this tweet exchange with Jane McAlevey. Well-known labor activist and author Jane McAlevey put out a series of sort of incendiary tweets right after the election, calling out national groups for not moving immediately to sort of call for large-scale national mobilizations in response to Trump's manipulations and his attempt to steal the election. You know, and some groups have been uneasy about calling for large-scale protests because of credible worries of violent attacks, and others are worried about sort of feeding into Trump's law and order story of unruly protesters as sort of a pretense to further repression. And I see the comrade Pete in the chat on Facebook lifting up a similar question. So, John, sort of what's your view of the sort of the timing and the importance of being in the streets in this moment to get Trump to sort of defer to the election results and get out of office?
Yeah, no, I think the same sort of broad array of forces that defeated him in the voting booth needs to be tapped into for calling him to concede now. I'll laugh and say Movement for Black Lives was ahead of the time when they were calling for Trump to resign. But I do think it's now time for Trump to concede. But I think, you know, I know there's labor groups having these conversations. I think state power groups are having these conversations. I think there's a range of folks that we should be coming together and mobilizing. And just, it's got to be duked out there in the streets, not physically duked out, just to be clear. But I think we need to bring it out there that if this is primarily a communication strategy, our communication has to be, this guy is, it's time to concede. All reasonable avenues have been pursued. Time to concede and move on with the transition, that we voted for a new president in a new direction. And I think there are the broad forces there. I'm not sure exactly what folks are waiting for, but it seems like it's pretty much on time. I think all the votes, I haven't seen the news today, but I think all the states have now been called. So it's time. The writing is more than on the wall. He lost. Time to go.
And Brandon, like, you know, what are your thoughts? Like, I know there was some pretty intense, I think the right wing folks went up, you know, well, already they had threatened, you know, the governor, there was that whole thing. And then after the election, there was a kind of mob scene, I believe, out of one of the voting centers.
Like, they pulled up to the main,
you know, what's that?
Yeah, they pulled up to the main voting center in the city, in the city of Detroit, not just any voting center, but where all of the absentee ballots were being counted, yeah. You know, the convention center. And so, you know, in the middle of the downtown Detroit, you know, you get 50 or so white folks, you know, banging on doors, you know, saying stop the vote. And so it harkens back to me as like dog whistles. You know, these are, you know, it's a dog whistle to say that folks in Philly, in Detroit, in Atlanta, wherever, can't count their votes. And we got to act. I'm sorry, my dog is trying to stay the show, but that black folks can't cast their own votes and can't count their own votes. And what we need to do is, you know, bring in, you know, another body. It's a dog whistle. It's almost like a bull or foghorn, to be honest. And I think that, you know, organizations like ours, like Detroit Action, we've been in the streets with a lot of our partners at Michigan Liberation, We the People Michigan, and other partners. As under this sort of banner of We Make Michigan, really to do exactly what you're saying is like call the question, push Trump to concede here in the state, and push, you know, people that are supporters to make, you know, to accept the results. Because I think that without doing that, you know, the comm side of it is that, you know, folks will feel emboldened to carry on the fight. And we have to actually, you know, as the left, we have to be willing to continue to push and make sure that those folks, you know, give it up. Like, the will of the people is spoken. And, you know, as John mentioned, you know, all of the states have practically been called. There's about 143,000 vote difference between Biden and Trump here in Michigan. There's no recount. There's no amount of, you know, lawsuits or whatever that that will overturn and get between that.
Yeah. And do you think that people, like, you know, because there haven't been, you know, the last few days haven't been, you know, such big protests, I think, you know, on CNN, they kind of talk about, like, oh, you know, it's set now, you know, we're good. But do you think that people are kind of ready to make noise, or do you think that people want to kind of watch and see what happens, and how are you approaching that?
I think so. I think people are interested in being out in the streets. You know, we did, you know, hosted a couple of the celebrations, you know, that were in Detroit the day after the election, as well as on the 7th. And for us, you know, what this moment means right now is that people are fired up. They're looking at this moment as having a taste of power. They're clear that, you know, right now, after these four long years, that, you know, community working together, building together, can do more. And I think for us as the left, you know, we have to give them something to work towards. We got to give them a big vision to be able to engage with. And, you know, that's what I'm hoping that, you know, we could take the next step on, is that, you know, now, like, you know, like you said, and like John said, like, being out in the streets in these moments, you know, pushing the sort of big vision narrative of, you know, why Trump should resign, why it's important that he packs it up now. And also, what can our communities do together, aside from just mobilizing to get somebody elected, is key.
Yeah. Yeah. Kendra, I want to come back to you. Council member, you know, as an elected official, you kind of live the inside outside strategy, right? That's sort of the subject of a lot of left debate. You ran as a Working Families Party candidate and won, which was, you know, amazing. But now you're on a council with that's largely sort of Democratic. Can you tell us a little bit about how groups came together to defeat Trump in Pennsylvania, and specifically in Philly? You know, we'd also really love to hear inside of that story how you see the struggle in the Democratic Party developing, right? Because this is sort of going to be the key question as we look forward. There was this broad front of groups that came together to defeat Trump. Now there's a question of sort of what is the internal struggle inside of the party look like? You know, is it up to our progressive electeds like you and movements in the street to turn up the heat on other people on other Democrats, you know, or will you sort of try to hold that coalition together against the right, because, you know, the Republicans still yield so much power? How do you sort of view that question?
You know, for me, the same coalition, the WFP coalition that helped me win my race in 2019, is the same coalition that came together to help bring this win for Joe Biden here in Philadelphia. You know, we're talking about service sector unions, Unite Here, 32BJ, as well as, you know, 215 People's Alliance, Reclaim Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Make the Road. Like, all of these groups came together to build this strong coalition in 2019. We mobilized again in 2020 to bring this win. And we're willing and ready to continue to mobilize, you know, moving forward. I think the reality of it, as, you know, a progressive candidate, a progressive elected, each election we have more. Like, even this election, we brought in two more. We have Nikhil Saval and Rick Kojewski, that both were Working Families endorsed candidates that ran from Movement Spaces, that took office, you know, that gained office but this past election. And the goal is to continue to build our progressive core, but also, you know, hold Democrats to the task. Like, I am from a movement. I'm an activist and organizer. That's what I did prior to becoming elected. And my commitment is still to the people in the streets. And what that looks like is that inside-outside strategy. As we continue to build power in this political arena, we have to continue to build power and empower people in the streets. Because, you know, it goes back to what I was saying before. For far too long, people have been disconnected to the party. It's been a very transactional relationship. I knock on your door, I tell you who to vote for, and you show up. That's it. Right now, in the time that we're in, people are more aware that the fact who we elect in office determines whether or not we have a vaccine for COVID-19. Whether or not you're able to be able to pay your rent or have some kind of rent subsidies in the midst of a national pandemic, you know, I think people are more aware and engaged, and that is the work. That is the inside outside strategy. Like, what can we do to empower people and empower the movement as we continue to build more political power on the left and hold, you know, traditional Democrats accountable to the things that the people in the street are calling for, whether it's from defunding the police to eviction moratoriums. That's something that's on my mind because that's been a lot of conversation about that around COVID-19. This is what it's all about. And I think that's the time we're in. I think here in Philadelphia and across the country, as we see more progressive electeds gain office, we will continue to have to push the Democratic Party. And sometimes I'm finding everybody is not really a push. It's just like, to pull along. Sometimes it's hard to stand out, but being elected as a progressive in the pure left and an independently elected person, I am not accountable to anybody except the people that got me into office. And I think that is where I hold the line, and that is the line that we have to continue to pull more Democrats too. Like, what are the people in the streets calling for? What are these movement spaces that won this victory for this country? What are they asking for? And continue to push them until we get what we want. And that's on a city, on a municipal level, on a state level, and also on a federal level.
Yeah, I don't know if you, I mean, this is to you, Ms. Brooks, but also anyone, like, I don't know if you all read there was an interview with AOC, with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the New York Times this weekend, you know, she was kind of, you know, complaining basically of how bad the Democratic Party has been treating her and the squad in terms of kind of icing them out and isolating them. And now, even after this election, now blaming people for making the kind of, you know, putting forward the platform and demands that, like, you're actually just talking about right now. It seems like an uphill battle. She kind of mentioned she barely wanted to run again. But at the same time, you know, there were more people added to the squad this cycle with Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman. So, yeah, just wondering if you see any parallels with what's happening on the national level and what's, you know, like how to keep that up without, you know, and be able to sustain this pressure when it seems like the majority of the Democratic Party is not having it. And right now, when they're facing the Georgia Senate runoffs, they're like, everybody needs to be quiet so we can win in this conservative state, you know, and stop talking all your radical stuff. So just wonder what you or others think about that.
I know, like, when I read that tweet, it resonated with me. And I'm not a Democrat, so I can only imagine. But the reality is, being a true progressive, being true to who we are in these spaces, it's our job to hold that line. And regardless of what the popular electoral body feels, the reality is that, you know, we won this election. In other areas, it's hard. But these tough conversations are why people elected the squad or progressive candidates across this country. And we have to hold our ground. And it's often uncomfortable. It's often not a great space to be in, but that's why we're here. So, you know, when I read that tweet, it resonated with me so much. But the reality is that the left won this election. Like, we mobilized, we organized to get, you know, Trump out of the White House, and some of the other elections where people saw the conversation around defund being problematic. I mean, that's an uphill battle that we have to continue to fight, because sometimes the truth is not easy. And we continually have to do more work around strengthening that messaging and bringing, like I said, more people to where we are. And that's why we're here. And it's hard. Like, I see the same. My experience is very much the same here as a municipal elected candidate. I voted to not fund the police, to defund the police budget. I have a couple colleagues that are still talking about defund, not giving additional money to the police department, and people feel very uncomfortable with that. But it's okay, because just the discomfort has kept us under oppression for all these years. So we have to continue to push the message and the narrative in order for us to be able to move towards the real change that we look to see.
In there, so I was pausing.
Just well, part I feel a little bit responsible, because I know that some of the attack came from the conservative Democratic congresswoman from Virginia who was going after AOC. And I think the information I saw going out was basically everybody who voted for Medicare for All, socialized medicine, everybody who voted for Medicare for All is either voted for it or ran on it. I think all but one, like won re-election or won their election. The point is, yeah, if you articulate a vision around things that we care about, it's aligned with what people want. If you look at who voted, you look at lower income people who earned less than $50,000 or families that earned less than $100,000, they voted for Joe Biden. But they didn't vote for Joe Biden because they want to continue without health insurance or paying through the teeth for health insurance. They voted because they wanted access to health care. So I just think two things. One is, you know, we need to be clear about that. And I think we're in the period right now where there's a battle over who won and who contributed. You know, the whole Cindy McCain, the Lincoln Project for $67 million, I'm thinking they turned out about 67 voters. So if you look at the numbers, they didn't turn over out many Republicans. So I think there's a whole battle within this same United Front around the different contending forces about what were the ideas and policies and personalities that really merit support and won it. So that's one piece of it. The second piece, when I read that piece, the article by AOC, it sort of saddened me as I realized we as a movement need to figure out how to circle the wagons and provide support for folks who've been really at the cutting edge of our demands and our struggles. And I'm not sure if it's, you know, what the institutional form looks like, but I definitely felt like a need for us to figure that out, because we got some people who are, you know, pretty far out there, whether it's at the city council level in Pennsylvania or Philadelphia or at the national level, AOC, the squad, and what's ever bigger than the squad, the battalion or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Thanks, John. Yeah. I want to come back and ask you a related question. Given that you're, you know, 10, 12 years ago when New Virginia Majority started up, y'all were in a swing state. You're no longer. And, you know, or at least by some measure. So I want to talk to you about sort of how you all are pivoting your strategy. But first, I want to bring Purvi back in. Purvi, as, you know, as the people's lawyer and someone who's been learning from movement comrades all over the world, really, for a long time, I want to talk to you about sort of what is next for us as we try to prevent a slide from democracy to authoritarianism. What's, you know, what is most important for us to keep in mind in this precarious situation we're in? A lot of people that came together to defeat Trump are choosing to trust the sort of institutional norms and safeguards following the election to restore some semblance of political normalcy, even if they plan to, you know, aggressively pursue social reforms under a Biden administration. But how should we be thinking about our participation in existing institutions versus transforming them? And who should we be rolling with to make it all happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really prescient question. And I think that I want to bring it back to this question about how do we move our agenda kind of at this point. And I think they're related. I mean, I think part of the reason why you're seeing the Democratic Party and the establishment not necessarily ringing the alarm bells around what's happening right now, and all of the things that I mentioned earlier, are a couple of reasons. I mean, I think one reason is smart. It is about not taking the bait and not sort of allowing this narrative of, you know, a sore loser narrative to kind of be the predominant narrative. But I think what undergirds it is a faith in the process, a faith in American democracy that I think many of the people on the left and many of the members of the organizations that make up the left have been disabused of this belief in American democracy, and particularly this American exceptionalism. Like, there's sort of a piece of disbelief that something like this could happen inside the establishment. And, you know, I say that about like Democratic Party lawyers or civil rights lawyers broadly. And I think that, you know, what is helpful is I think for those of us that are questioning the way policing has happened or mass incarceration or a range of other things that are at the heart of progressive demands, COVID, access to healthcare, or, you know, ending evictions in a pandemic, we understand that a lot of these systems that undergird our democracy, like, actually are flawed. And so I think this idea that we can question, you know, even we can believe in democracy and I think have a very clear understanding that American democracy is flawed. So I think what that means is taking the threat seriously and thinking about also, I think, it's a sort of how can we achieve a division of labor in our movements? We can have one part of our movement that is really focused on the short-term defensive, you know, strategy of making sure these election results are enforced, right? And there's a whole range of strategies there. I think what's also happening is without a division of labor, we're also not necessarily pushing on the transition plans and on the Biden administration in terms of a range of decisions they'll make during a transition that will set us up for some of these progressive fights that really are why our people got mobilized and went out to the polls, right? So I would say that to me, it's about like if we had an inside outside strategy in terms of trying to win the election, like what is our inside outside strategy now? You know, how can we actually develop a strategy in which some of us are actually trying to ensure that the election outcome is respected while we simultaneously are pushing to stop a neoliberal agenda from taking over the next administration. And I think right now we feel like we have to choose one or the other. And I think my push is to say we should be doing both, and we should be doing both aggressively.
That's great. Brandon, before I go over to John, I thought I might've seen you trying to get in earlier. Do you want to hop in?
I mean, I think the only thing I would just add to what John said is that, you know, here in Michigan, we see the sort of neoliberal centrist Democratic Party, you know, beat up and try and gang up on Rashida Tlaib, you know, other member of the squad. And when you look at the numbers and you look at like the work that she did to turn out voters here in the 13th congressional district and really throughout the state, you see a lot more impact from her from her electoral program or from the electoral programs like us and our allies than you see in those sort of traditional, you know, Democratic spaces. And the reason why is that she's able to better connect to her electorate, you know, from her story of being a working class Detroiter, but then B, through imagining and trying to work to create policy that actually speaks to the needs of the people. You know, when we were talking to her earlier last year about opportunity zones and like, what does it look like to go after and challenge opportunity zones and challenge the big business billionaires who will benefit from her, you know, she immediately got it. And so, you know, the idea around like circling a wagon and supporting those folks is, you know, it has to be our community organizations. It has to be folks like the WFP that do that, you know, because at the end of the day, we all we got. You know, I think that that's what it looks like in this moment. And it looks like being able to absorb some of the folks who are coming out of this election and coming in and even maybe the from 2018, you know, who are just sick and tired of seeing as politics as usual. You know, I don't think that I don't think we have any real other way if we want to be able to protect and defend the folks who will fight for, you know, a Green New Deal or Medicare for all or, you know, defunding police and, you know, things like the BREATHE Act. You know, we actually have to grow our own crops and circle the wagon to defend them.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think the question, you know, it comes back to something that I think Rishi was going to ask you about, John, but is, you know, you have been, you and Tram and folks have been organizing in a state, you know, through when it was a red state, a swing state, you know, and you know, even now, I don't know if you'd call it that or not, but through a real transformation of the state, you know, political kind of balance of power. And it raises a question about strategy, right? Because that's a key thing. We saw several more states flip this time. And what happens next? You know, now you have some sway in the legislature. You're able to pass some progressive policies, but you're faced with some of these challenges that others are describing, the kind of neoliberal Democrats in a state. What is the kind of next level of strategy once you've kind of made that flip? Or is it really just about holding it down for as long as possible?
No, we've achieved a lot, but we got in 13 years of grinding out there, you know, building a base, sort of building, if you will, the block or the united front that we want across the state to win. We've been doing that, but there's several things. One is the extent that we have narrow majorities that would be supportive of our policies, we push for things that are going to build more power. So what are the things that we can do that make it easier to vote? 45 days, no excuse, absentee balloting, drop boxes, not one per county, but all over the place. I mean, the point is, Virginia went from one of the most restrictive set of laws around voting to, I think, we're number 12 in the country by some measure. And it makes a huge difference. We had more people voting in advance of the election than voted altogether in 2016. And we built at a state level, it went from a narrow Clinton victory, for example, last time in 16, to a 10-point victory statewide for Biden. But that's not enough. But again, everything we're doing is about building power. So at the state level, again, these are baby steps. We're still in a very conservative state, but it's a baby step, is allowing public sector unions to have bargain for a contract. I know for some of y'all from Michigan, it might sound like a crazy thing to think that you have to bargain for that. But we basically had enabling legislation this year. So unions can go to localities and say, will you let us have a pass legislation allowing us to have a local bargaining unit? And that's happening in a number of jurisdictions. So what are the things we can pass in the South, in the right to work South, in the racist white right to work South? We've had more Confederate statues than anybody else. And I can tell you one thing about those statues, by the way, they can't swim. Every one of them, they drop in the water, they can't swim, but that's over there. But the real thing here is, what are the things we can do that can change the power? So it's like, what are the things around, you know, getting ready to obstacles to voting? When our people vote, we win. What are the things we can do that can help build power through unions? When our people have unions, we win. Those are the kinds of things that we need to look to replicate. And then I'd say we're at the point now where we're at a state that's narrowly Democratic, particularly at the state Senate level, but it's really, are there strategic sort of, both at the statewide offices, strategic interventions where we can get a leading progressive governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, actually we have is pretty good. So that's one piece of it. And then quite frankly, where are the primary opportunities? Where are some of these sort of tired and old Democrats who've stood by payday lending, who have stood by all sorts of better for business than for the people sort of policies? Who are the few that we can knock out and send a message to the rest of them about what direction we want to move? So that's sort of like our next step. And I think one last piece that we're doing is also, how do we start? We trained up in Virginia a whole generation of folks who have our view on how you build power in the streets, how you build it by doing the organizing in terms of the voter vote work, in terms of who you target, in terms of working class people of color, and you move that work. And now we need to get people inside who are the chief of staff, who are in the administration, who are on the inside in a different way, not just winning elected office, but actually with the administration of the new laws that will actually help us bring, you know, if you will, bring home some of the fruits of our struggle to the communities that we represent. So that's sort of where I see this next period of time. And I'm hopeful we can do it with a lot of brothers and sisters across the South. As I think one last piece I'll make, a little off topic here, but there's really the contours of a new South, a new solid South that is going to be progressive, going to be a bedrock of progressivism. If you go from Arizona in the Southwest to Georgia and Virginia in the Southeast and a couple other on the cusp, we can start talking about an anchor for progressive change in this country coming from a place that people didn't think it would be coming from.
That's excellent, John. And I'll just say that we will ask an open question about Georgia, if any, in case anybody wants to jump in, because obviously there's about to be, you know, a rush of energy and attention into Georgia around these Senate elections over the next couple months. So, you know, we're really interested in people weighing in. But while folks are gathering their thoughts about that, I wanted to ask maybe our second to last question to Brandon. You know, Brandon, one of the most interesting things about Michigan electorally is that, you know, John's raised the sort of the need for new majority type groups like Detroit Action and like others to primary, you know, sort of establishment Dems that have rejected a progressive agenda to their own peril for a long time. One of the most interesting things that's about Michigan is that both Bernie and Jesse Jackson won their primaries, well, at least in 88 with Jesse, you know, on a left, multiracial, working class, populist political program, right? So that's really interesting because Bernie and Jesse basically didn't win almost anywhere else in common, but they won it in Michigan. So I guess a couple questions, you know, does the 2020 election, you know, in Michigan and but just even nationally, does it show us that the multiracial working class is organizable around a left progressive agenda? Or is it, you know, as a lot of people claim, and even as Biden sort of claims, that it's really kind of the old legacy of the Democratic Party that's most responsible for bringing that block of voters together?
Nah, I mean, definitely on the last point, I don't think it's the old legacy block. I think when you look at like places like Wayne County, where, you know, where Detroit is, when you look at, you know, the sort of rising electorate of Black folks, increased numbers of Latinx residents here on the southwest side of Detroit and downriver, you know, Muslim Americans and Bengali Americans, you know, Yemeni folks in Detroit, Hamtramck, Dearborn, et cetera, you know, you see a new pathway forward of building this sort of multicultural populist movement that's able to shift policy and politics for one of the most populous parts of the county. So, you know, in Wayne County and in southeastern Michigan, where I'm at, you know, 1/5 of Biden's votes came from here. And then when you think about like how do you rebuild the sort of leftist populist movement, you know, for this, you know, for the state, one of the things that Bernie did really well in 2016 that he didn't do as well was build upon sort of like rural white votes on the west side of the state, as well and tying those folks to those rising electorates that I mentioned both here, but on the west side of the state in places like Ottawa County, where you know, there's a large rising Latin American constituency. So I think that like what we've been trying to show as Detroit Action is like the pathway forward is there. And it's there when you talk to people about things that they care about. And it's there when you don't don't shy away from race. You know, our super PAC Michigan Action, we partnered with our friends at the Michigan Asian American Progressives. And we talked to Asian Americans in Oakland County and really throughout the state about, you know, about the same things that we would talk to Black folks about. And we talked to them about things that they want to see for their communities and actually, you know, combating Trump's racism. And so I think that the pathway is there, but the one thing that's clear, and it's clear coming out of 16, and clear coming out of this year, is that if we allow the consultant class, if we allow the folks like the Lincoln Party or the Lincoln Project rather, and all those sort of crews to sort of define the election for us and define this win for us, then we'll get painted out of the picture. What they'll do is say that what we need to do is, you know, do more TV ads, target, you know, the suburbs, you know, target folks that don't look like me. And, you know, the we'll be back to this sort of narrow confines of transactional politics that's only benefits big business as usual, instead of the politics that actually matters to the folks that are in our base. And so when I think about building the sort of multicultural populist movement that we want to see here in Michigan, it starts with the folks that look like me. It starts with the folks that are in our base, but it includes working folks. It includes the people who you know, who have a skin in the game. If this, you know, based on the policy that we get, and you know, it at the end of the day, it starts with organizing, and it means bringing those folks into our base to see that we have a mutual self-interest and mutual shared values, and that working together, we can enact those.
Thanks, man. We are running up on time, but I've heard some really good kind of strategies tonight in terms of both the need to that folks are thinking that we do need to kind of get back out there and make sure we're clear that Trump needs to leave. We talked about kind of the need to continue building this power in the states and making these long-term transitions to wage fights even within the Democratic Party for more progressive change once even a state flips. We're talking about the coalition that needs to be built. I want to give anyone a last word. I don't know if Kendra or Kirby have any thoughts that you want to close us out with about what needs to be done as we look to Georgia and to hopefully the end of the Trump regime in a few months.
Well, I don't have thoughts on specifically on Georgia, but I did want to say that I think it's really important to use, like, to understand that fighting to stop a contested, you know, the stopping Trump from contesting this election is actually part of our long-term strategy, because even if he's not able to effectively shift the outcomes of this election, it's all a narrative setup for the next midterms and elections. And so just really seeing our response to the contested, to this threat of a contested election is very much tied to our long-term goals. And really thinking about, you know, if this is a narrative and a mobilization strategy, like, how are we prepping our bases to activate? Because I do think that there is a sort of sense of, like, you know, how can we kind of make sure? And just the last point I want to say is this is a lesson from the 2000 election and the playbook of the 2000 election, and the fact that our side was not quite able to mobilize as quickly as the other side, and they disrupted the recount process. And that led to the results that we all know. So, you know, if we are heading into a recount in Georgia, and I'll let, you know, kind of Kendra have the last word on this, but I think that if we are heading to a recount there, which seems fairly likely, then what is our mobilization strategy to ensure the chaos and disruption of their side is not going to be used to delegitimize, you know, the election outcomes?
Any last thoughts, Councilwoman?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. I think that we just have to stay prepared and be prepared both ways. We have to plan for what's next and also prepare and stay vigilant about where we are. And that's kind of to what she was speaking to. And, you know, I think that's the message. That's, we have to be very clear that, you know, we can't sit back, and we have to continue pressing towards the victory that we want. We want Trump out, but we also want the radical change that we'd like to see in the White House. And we have to do both at the same time, right at this moment.
We always have it so easy on our side. Well, that's going to be a wrap for us for tonight. Thank you all so much for just kind of bringing all the individual perspectives from your work. I think it came together with some really powerful statements and ideas for what folks need to be focusing on right now. And, you know, we can still celebrate. We had some major victories, but as we've heard tonight, we still have so much work to do. Rishi, you want to close us out for the evening?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. And thanks to all of our guests. Really, really excellent discussion. You know, I think what's very clear, there's sort of this, you know, clarion call to stay vigilant, which I think is right. And what I feel just really optimistic about is that our movements, you know, compared to just 4 years ago, are just so much more prepared and skilled and experienced inside of executing electoral strategy, in having real concrete experience to even have a conversation about what inside-outside strategy means. So I'm feeling optimistic about the sorts of conversations that we can actually have with each other about the terrain of struggle moving forward, the key interventions that we have to make, and actually charting a path forward. So stay tuned for future episodes of This Is Not a Drill Live. Keep fighting, keep organizing, keep rising up, be powerful. Till the next episode, good night. All right.